welcome to another edition of Kaleidoscope. This is Magda Zenon, recording from downtown Nicosia in my virtual studio. And with me, from the same island, but in Famagusta, I have Nafia Akdeniz. Welcome, Nafia.
Hello, hello.
To put everyone in the loop of who Nafia is a poet, an ethnographer, and an interdisciplinary qualitative researcher. But I think what she is mainly, because this defines who Nafia is, and I think she might agree, is she is person of the in-betweennesses, because she was born after the invasion of 74. She was part of the post-war divisions, and she considers herself a citizen of borders, buffer zones, and everything in between. How am I doing, Nafia? Does that describe you?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
So Nafia, tell me who Nafia is. Tell me your journey. How did you reach where you are? Or tell me the journey of your life, because to also add to your picture, Nafia is also the person that made me realize what my home is, which is a big word. Okay. So we have had a lot of conversations. So Nafia, who is Nafia and what does she consider home?
Oh, that's a very, very big question, Magna. I might need some help to narrow that down. Well, I always define my identity as an islander to depoliterize Cyprus, because this is the only time that I feel at home and in peace. When I start defining myself as an islander, enjoying the climate, enjoying, I don't know, the island life with the beaches and the sand and the sun shining over my head all the time. Apart from this, of course, born into the conflict of Cyprus, which is still ongoing, I find myself in a position to question my political existence on the island. And it's been 50 years, that's my age, and I have been doing my best to continue the struggle for the peace on the island. And as a poet, I always, you know, push the limits of seeing how my academic work can be approached from artistic, you know, point of view, because art has the power to galvanize people to, you know, put things into action rather than academia.
Well, I also believe that art has the ability to disconnect from the public political narrative, which is divisive on both sides of the checkpoint, the green line. So by approaching it from a perspective of art or theater or music or poetry, you disconnect from that divisive narrative and you find a narrative that brings you together or gives you a holistic perspective. I've always believed that even though I am part of the political narrative, but I've always believed that the creative has far more ability to join us and to take us forward to peace, because the public narrative, the political narrative, we're not doing anything. We're not getting anywhere.
Our art is political, so we do what we do with art.
But it's not controlled by the state. The art is controlled by the state.
You challenge the mainstream political narrative.
Exactly.
To bring new narratives, to bring narratives that would amplify the commons of the people on the island. This is what the art is doing. I mean, if you just have a look at the last exhibition we had at the Buffer Zone, Imagining Home, this is a kind of example of how we transform a space which is politically dividing, but when you transform it into a space where you can invite people to get together, the space starts telling another narrative. And in that space, it's a collective art exhibition, so we had different people from different disciplines trying to elaborate on the idea of home. Have you been there?
I was actually there on the opening night. And I agree with you when the art puts forward perspectives that challenges the general public political narrative. helps you rethink things a lot of the time, or think see things in a different way. I found a lot of it fascinating, especially those little wired homes on the wall.
Yeah,
On the one where I found those absolutely so inspiring.
the interesting thing is to add before we move on to another point is during the preparations of the exhibition, we artists have realized how, without knowing or without informing each other, how we end up retelling the same story in different forms. Like you mentioned of those homes, skeleton homes with wires. Julie came to me and said, "Nafia, you know what? I think this one is exactly describing what you are saying in your poem, a Cypriot kind of glimpse." Because the structure was kind of giving the people a sense of, you know, bending yourself in and out to have a glimpse over something. So that was also a great awareness and recognition for the artists, you know, when you get together around a theme, no matter which discipline you're coming from, no matter in which form you're creating your art, be it with words or pictures or buyers, you end up telling a common story in different forms, and that matters.
And what actually matters is the fact that every piece of work generates a conversation.
Yeah, definitely.
Generates a conversation, and mine might not coincide with yours, but it generates a conversation, which means you're ch challenging the political public narrative. And we aren't doing it enough. And this blame lies on no one, but we need to be challenging that public political narrative. Because we need to move forward, we need to be healing, we need to be having conversations. Because we might disagree, we might agree, but we need to be talking to each other. We don't need to be listening to what they're telling us. Tell me your journey of this trying to find a home, because a lot of your work recently has been done with what home means to you. I remember you did an event in Rustem 2 or 3 months ago. And that's the event that I attended. And I'd been wanting to do a tattoo for years, and I couldn't work out what I wanted a tattoo of. And it was going to be an angel because my son's name is Angelos, and I collect angels. And then I thought, no. And then you showed a flower in your presentation. And I thought, if I had a flower, what would that flower be? And the flower would have been an olive tree. Plant would have been an olive tree. And that led to me getting a tattoo of an olive branch. So to me, these public conversations in the most random ways influence all of us. So tell me about how this journey of your finding home.
Well, as I said, every time I struggle through the given political identities, I end up finding refuge in nature, depoliticizing Cyprus. And during the panel that you mentioned, which made you have a tattoo, olive tree tattoo, I was talking about spaces, public spaces, which is different from private properties, public spaces where we feel at home. Because in a public space, we become not only an individual, but also a part of community. And for me, I mean, I define my refuge on this island as the sand hills of Karpaz. And I was defining my identification with the oleander flower there. And I read the poem related to that. But in fact, the poem has almost nothing to do with the oleander itself, but how it is located at the top of a hill, naturally with no human maintenance and surviving. This resistance of a flower blossoming in the middle of nowhere with no human interference, let's say, rather than maintenance, inspires me a lot. And I feel, okay, I need to be as strong as an oleander. I need to be as strong as an olive tree. These are not, you know, cliche traditional symbols of Cyprus. These are the what the nature teaches us. I mean, I do observe the people. Like my specific field of observation is the experience, the lived experience of refugee life, in particular the Varoshian refugees. But I also do observe nature. I mean, I do look at how we can learn from the nature, and trees are the best teachers. And the wildflowers, they always inspire me. So this is the question in my mind, like, where on earth, not only in Cyprus, where on earth would you feel at home in nature, in a public space where I don't own it? Like, it's not my,
Doesn't
personal
belong
property.
to me.
Doesn't belong to me, but I feel belong to it. That's the feeling I'm chasing after. That's the feeling I'm trying to understand. How can I, and why do I feel belong to a place that I don't own? And how can we, like, multiply this feeling? How can we deepen that feeling? Because this is where we can learn to coexist, if what I'm saying makes sense to you. Like, tell me about your process of identifying yourself with the olive tree, because I believe it will be similar.
I don't know what it is. I don't actually know what it is, but it is so deep that when I was have been watching this Gaza Israeli crisis developing in front of us, one of the things that actually broke my heart the most was when I saw the Israeli army cutting down olive trees. Because I think olive trees, especially in this part of the world, is very much part of who we are. It's resilient. It's glorious when we're on a sunny day with those silver leaves. It's glorious. It just shines, but it shines without being flashy. It shines because of the color of the green. It doesn't shine because it's gold or flowery or anything. It just shines because of what it is. It's got history. It's not perfect.
It's a cultural heritage.
It's
It's
cultural heritage. It's not
belongs
perfect
to
because when you
them.
see the trunk, it's gnarled and twisted. So to me, the fact that it's still here and it's still glorious is
Survive.
what, and it survived, it's what touched me. When I saw those trees being cut down of 100 or 200 or 300 years old, I thought my heart was being pulled out. Imagine how the Palestinians felt. But to me, it's the fact that these olive trees that are a symbol of the heritage of who we are. As you said, I belong to it. It doesn't belong to me. When I see it, I feel safe. When I see it, I'm calm. It broke my heart. So I think that's why when I was listening to you speaking about the oleander, and I was processing what you were talking about in my brain, that is why suddenly the olive tree just fell in. Because I also, when I first came to Cyprus, I lived with an aunt here, who's single aunt, my father's sister, had this lovely home with olive trees in the back. People now, she passed away a few years ago. She left me the house that I had to sell, but people said to me, "Why don't you go to a grave?" And I said, "I don't need to go to a grave. I've got an olive tree in my veranda, and when I look at that olive tree, I'm thinking of my aunt. I'm thinking of my connection to her. The olive tree is what connects us. I don't need a grave to connect us, or a tombstone to connect us." So to me, this journey, that moment was instant during that event that I said, "You know what? It's the olive tree. It's the olive tree." And I found the perfect tattoo, and I've got it on here, and I've had it only for 3 months, and yet I've feel as if I've had it forever, because this is who I am. This I carry my home with me.
It belongs to the collective memory, and the attack to that tree, be it in
Exactly.
Syria, be it in Cyprus, be it in Palestine, it's an attack to your cultural heritage. I mean, this is how you feel belong to that thing. And all these attacks are intentional. It's an intentional harm to the cultural heritage where you yourself also feel belong, because it's part of your being. You
Yes.
don't have to have a specific tree. It's olive tree in general for everyone. And
Absolutely.
what I like about the oleander flower, it's I like to play with the idea of it being poisonous as well. And I was consulting to my biologist friends about this oleander flower being poisonous after reading a lot of articles of how it's not poisonous unless you make, tea out of it. Still, the idea of poison in its roots, it's a strong metaphor for me to think of home as sweet home, but unless you know how to make it sweet for everyone, think of it in terms of homeland, it can get poisonous. So maybe that's why I'm more into the oleander flower, which is wild flowers surviving at the top of the hill, and I call my temple this idea of sweet home and poisonous home, because turn home into a comfort zone should not mean turn somebody else's life into hell.
Yes.
That's the point I was trying to make with this oleander flower.
But it is strange. I mean, this discussion about home, I don't know how many people actually sit and have it to consider what, and maybe I've had it more because I was born in South Africa. I moved to Greece. I then spent time in the States. And then I came to Cyprus. So to me, it was very difficult to actually define a specific home because I had moved so much. And maybe that's why when you spoke about plants and I suddenly zoomed in on the olive tree, maybe that's why it hit home more because I don't have a home per se. I've moved so much. So home
Yeah,
is a much deeper meaning.
sure. That's why every time I'm asked the reason why I am studying the case of Varosha as someone who's not from even Famagusta, let alone having anything to do with the specific area of Famagusta called Varosha, I tell the story of how I used to walk by the barbed wire. For years, during my preliminary observations, I used to walk by the barbed wire trying to have a look at the homes inside and imagine the kind of life they lived, I felt kind of vacuumed into that empty space of no people, of no human settlement. And I was like questioning myself, why am I so obsessed with a home with no person? Looking at those homes and trying to imagine a kind of life lived there. It should have been about me rather than about the people of Arusha to start with. And I ended up finding the people of those homes and talking to them. And during the conversations, the interviews I had with the people of Arusha have never been question and answer session. We always had a conversation, a dialogue, them questioning me as well, because I was sitting there not only as a researcher trying to learn things from them, but also as a Cypriot, a Turkish-speaking Cypriot, trying to make sense of this experience of enforced displacement. And although I was not from Varosha, I felt very connected and related to the experience of not being able to arrive at home in my case. In their case, it's returning home. And we together talked about the sense of belonging into a country, not a specific private property, not a specific city. How can we belong into a country? How can we define homeland? And when we look at the case of Arusha, it's where you can see the Cyprus problem going on with naked eyes. It's front of you. It's
Yes.
in front of your eyes, and it's a reminder of the problem itself, because I do also ask this question, who is the Cyprus problem for? Who is it really waking up in the morning and saying, okay, what am I doing today to keep this energy of searching for peace on this island? Am I in peace? Is Cyprus in peace? Who is for whose we have the problem going on? So when I talk to the people of Varosha, whose homes have been a hostage, a military hostage, I feel my country has been a political hostage, and the country, I mean the country that I want to live in the future, is where I do feel forcibly displaced. I mean, I feel displaced from the future of my country because I can't arrive to the desired country that I imagine to create, which is one Cyprus in peace. And the case of Varosha, in case of Varosha, they dream of returning. So this idea of returning and arriving becomes one desire that galvanized the action for us to keep doing something to bring peace to the island together. It's not about Varosha. It's not about any other specific area. It becomes a country issue, common issue, public space issue, rather than private home issue.
Now, I agree with you. The fact that Varosha has been held hostage for the past 15 years and hung before our eyes, backwards and forwards and to the side. I'm also not a Varoshotisa. I have roots in Karpasia. But to me, you see that happening and you see how both sides are using this carrot, Varosha, to manipulate public opinion and to manipulate their opponent, who shouldn't be an opponent, but should be a team, their co-conspirator. That's the wrong word. They should be working together, not one against the other. So I agree with you. It is, Varosha is our common journey and our common hostage. I mean, I don't go there often because I want to cry, and I imagine how much the people that had to leave their homes feel want to cry. But it's a very big issue, and I think if we discuss it more, we also move a little bit away from what actually belongs to us, because everything belongs to us and nothing belongs to us. So it's not the fact that I want to go to my home, the bricks. I want to go back to a space. I want to go back to a shared space, which is what you're saying. Reunited in peace. So your space is shared. It's not one specific building.
Yes, when you say shared space, that brings us back to public space, which is for the community, not only for specific individuals. And my recent poetry project that I collaborated with D6EU, which is an NGO, inspiring and facilitating art activities multiculturally and interculturally,
That's with
is.
my friend Angirot Tumazo.
Yeah,
Tumazo.
and the project basically is to create poems on the public space memory in Varosha. I mean that's of course I drawing on my findings from my academic work. I said, okay, now it's time to do something on specifically on public space and memory, because my research says when the people of Varosha ask to reclaim their homes, they don't reclaim the private property only, they also reclaim public spaces like their schools, their libraries, their art galleries, their parks, gardens, cinemas, theaters, the public space.
Exactly.
So I thought, okay, now I want to zoom into the public space memory and try to retell, re-narrate the story of public spaces in the form of poetry. And that was a real challenge to me, in for two reasons, let's say. One, I kind of accepted the task to transform scientific data into poetry.
Okay.
That's one thing. And the other thing is, when you sit to write poems, if you have already an ingredient in you and you just want need to work on, with these ingredients, the knowledge I know, the findings I know already from my research, that's another challenge because poetry is a creative work, and the easiest way is to sit in front of an empty page and start doing. But my page was not empty; it was already loaded with information, and my task, my job was to transform that information, that knowledge into an artistic way so that I can reach, I can communicate that information with different kinds of audience. Poetry, art do circulate better than academia. It does, communicate with audience in totally different ways than academia does. So I accepted the challenge, and I did my best to retell the memory of public spaces. And I created three different poetry stations in Varosha. The first thing that comes up always has been the sea, how the sea life was lived and missed.
Okay.
And okay, I said, all right, let's do something to do with the sea. And that's one station. And I ended up having three poems in the sea station. And then I moved into the city. We have a map for this, and it's accessible to everyone. Then we moved to into the city, and I created a garden station for people walking in the Varosha. And garden station is where the people of Varosha kept talking about how the municipal garden was a kind of public space for them, where they had their breaks, their fun, their celebrations, their festivals, Orange Festival, this celebration, that celebration. So it has become a space for the collective memory, and they wanted to claim that space. And surrounding that garden was their affairs that they kept mentioning, like Edelweiss and Boccaccio. They kept talking about art school, Lyceum
Okay.
for women. And behind that garden was their gymnasium. So I created a station of poetry where they can hear the poem talking about all these public spaces and the memory of it. Then one more station at Agora, which is a kind of out of the accessible area, but you have to stretch your body or bend your body somehow, do something with your body to have a glimpse of the facade. And this inspired me to write the last poem in the project, the Cypriot kind of glimpse. And from that specific agora spot, it becomes more general, more common, more collective experience of how we stretch our bodies to see things over the barbed wires, over rusted barrels, over borders. This is becoming our physical feature. We always stretch ourselves or bend ourselves between the things, over the things, to be able to see what's forbidden to us, and a military zone, Varosha is the military zone, demands you, like orders you to stop somewhere. And if you want to see ahead, you have to do things with your body, reach your body.
I remember going with friends to Varosha, and it was before the opening of Varosha. It must have been about 10, 15 years ago. And we actually stepped into a stadium and stepped up the steps of the stadium to see into the forbidden, the closed city of Varosha. It's what you say, you put yourself in, not out of your comfort zone, to see things that they're trying to keep hidden away from you. Tell me, is this available on a website?
It is available on our
Send
website.
it to me, and I'll put when I upload your podcast, I will put the website because I think a lot of people would be interested to explore it.
Yeah, of course. It is designed in two different ways. One online, where you can have access to the poems as videos. The on-site one is through an application called Echoes. So all you need to do is to download the application, start walking in Marosha, and
And
once
it's
you
ECOS. What's it called? ECOS.
Yes, but once you have a look at the link I will be sharing with you, you can have information, detailed information about
Oh,
online
good.
or on-site versions of it. We have three languages available. It's in Turkish, English, and Greek. So I'm curious about the feedback I will be receiving to this project because it's a highly sensitive subject, and I was very, very careful in not turning this project into part of dark tourism, because the whole aim is to create a counter narrative to this.
Okay.
You know, you are entering a military zone, which is a city of people who were forced to leave and express their desire to return. And it's open as a part of dark tourism post-war site. And with my poetry, what I'm trying to do, as I said, is to create a counter narratives, zooming or highlighting the memory there to create a kind of empathy for people who left the place. So when you sit in a garden and look at the school you studied in, this should create, once you know what happened there through poetry, this should create a kind of empathic space for you to remember your own high school, your own garden, your own cafe that you spent your youth in. When you look at somebody else's public space, you know, I the reason I've chosen public spaces, yes, it was the research finding that public space is also is more important than the private space when it comes to claiming the place as a community. But public space is something that anyone, anywhere in the world can relate to. We all have schools. We all have gardens, we all have cafes, we all have, you know, libraries in our lives. And imagine, like the tree, the olive tree attack that breaks your heart, imagine an attack to your own school, to your own library, to own garden. I mean, an attack to the oleander flower at the top of the hill of Karpaz will break my heart from my root. You know, it because I feel I belong to it. And it the olive tree, you say, the school, the library, all these public spaces with common collective memory is where we can get together to practice coexistence with empathy. So I do would like to receive comments and criticism on how the poetry is functioning in that sense when people enter Varosha with this exposition, let's say.
I'd be interested to I mean, I too would be interested to explore and examine, and I surely will come back to you with a comments. Criticism is not a nice as a word I don't use. I prefer comments.
You know,
Positive
we do.
commentary.
We do need constructive criticism
Yes.
because I mean I've been studying Russia for a decade now, and I'm so involved in it. And you need an eye to have a look at you know. I always
But
had,
that's what I mean. That's a constructive criticism, not a okay.
okay.
When in listening to you at a listed extent, I recently did an interview because I think a lot of the time all this discourse needs to be put in a format that we all understand because we don't all necessarily, as you said, identify with something. An interview I recently did with a researcher in Luxembourg, she was researching godmothers of soldiers of the World War I. okay, which is a group of women that used to empower, help support me, and to make it more accessible and more part of the conversation, she turned it into a comic book.
I saw that. You published it as a podcast, one of the podcasts,
Yes.
Kaleidoscope.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh.
So to me, this thing of actually making issues that we should be talking about, putting them in a format that make them more conversational, is exceptionally important, because we cannot assume, we've got to assume that everyone needs to be part of this conversation. So put it in a format that everyone has access to, or everyone can identify to. So I thank you. I will be looking over it
Yeah, this
very
is exactly
closely.
what I'm trying to do. I mean, the comic books, poetry, art piece, any, I mean, these are all part of activism, if you ask me. Like
Exactly.
this is being an activist for me, like writing a poem on the memory, collective memory of public spaces in Marosha for people to know. And to think and to question and to know that it's not a place that you can have a selfie with while laughing. There is a memory that you should respect, you should know, but you can't respect without knowing. And this knowledge creating of knowledge creation, when you put it into an accessible formats like poetry or comic books in that case becomes part of activism because you actively interfere with the mainstream narrative. You create a new one. You create a one that is it is it can communicate with different forms. So I call my work activism.
Now, of course, it's activism, because you're actually trying to, you're pushing things forward, and you're pushing things forward in a way that's works for you. Because standing, demonstrating in front of parliament buildings doesn't work for everyone. And it doesn't, you need to be an activist at different levels. That's why I've always claimed that we really need to push forward and encourage art activism, whether it's comic books, artwork, poetry, theatre or music. It's far more effective, because it's got a broader appeal. So it means it will reach more people. Reach more people. Tell me, besides writing poetry, do you, what else do you do? What else inspires you? I know that's a difficult question to answer, because people ask me the same question.
I am an academic as well, so my job is to kind of merge both academia and my poetry to start with. To start my creative work, let's say, because I do the same with academia. I am an activist academic because I am interested in community-driven research. I mean, I don't believe in academia that stays on the shelves of the libraries and get dusted. I mean, I am interested in science, any scientific work. That will serve for the betterment of the community, not for the, I don't know, for the betterment of the academic himself or herself, or for the governmental institutions. So, me transforming my academic work into poetry is kind of double activism. I am an activist academic and I am an activist artist in this sense. So this is my job and my creative skill merging together, let's say. But apart from this, I don't want to be writing poems only on Cyprus, in Vienna.
I hope not.
Because yes, we do get inspired from the circumstances, the political circumstances of places we live in, but in the end, I am a human, I am a woman, I am a mother, so I do want to relate to other humanly passions as well. But I like trying different forms of expressions. Like it's not only this last poetry project that I, experimented something new. Before this, I was trying to rewrite interview transcript as short haiku poems, believing in the power of less compared to more. Haiku poems is short Japanese inspired poems where you get the kind of very strong image that will stay with you forever. Like it's and I was listening to long interviews, and when I transcribed 45 interviews, I ended up having more than 800 pages long. Yes, I have this, chunk of work that I had to deal with. You have, I mean, I'm interested in finding ways of communicating that chunk of work with people. Otherwise, it's just a chunk of work staying at my desk. I don't see the meaning in this. I mean, I collected this, and now it was my job, I felt at the time of transcribing the interviews, to find ways of reaching out to people.
And
And
unless
yes,
you do it briefly, it's not going to get there. Unless you do it shortly.
you have to find a
The
power.
essence.
The essence of it, yeah, that's the right word. Haiku is to do with the essence, and it gives you a scene, a landscape, a scene, a mindscape. And I wanted to tell those, long stories in short forms, images, so that people can keep it and circulate it. Like the first one. The most, I mean, my I think my favorite so far. Those haikus were part of the exhibition as well. If you remember, on the wall with visuals.
Yes.
This is how I started experimenting poetry writing with my academic work. And the first one was, I was told a story of someone whose mother from La Rocha. Never planted the flowers and the trees in the ground, but always planted them in the pot, thinking that when she returned to Varosha back in her home, she would then plant the trees into
The
the ground
land. Okay.
so that it could the plants can be rooted in the right place rather than a temporary place, And she was giving me all these story of her mother, how she died before that happened. But I was stuck with this image of someone not planting trees in the land, but in pots. Don't you think this is a very powerful
Yes,
image?
it is.
And like it's a resistance to the temporary situation of
Displacement.
a displacement, living somewhere to show that it's temporary.
Yes.
Show that it's temporary. They would never accept the fact that now we are in our new home. Because the moment you feel at home, you start planting trees. And the home goes, the tree stays. And still you have your home. You still feel
Yes.
you have a sense of belonging there.
A
And I
very
told
strong image. It's a
her,
very strong image.
it's a very, very strong image. And I said, okay, I can turn this into a poem. Very short poem that would circulate around and around easily, and it will stay with people because it tells the best of what it means to feel you are temporarily somewhere waiting to return home. This temporariness of homeness.
So she
Yeah,
put the trees in the same position she was in.
definitely, definitely. And I said, okay, that's a poem. That is a poem. You have to see the poem in this, more than 800 pages long stories.
And can
And
you recite it to us?
It's just a very, very short poem, the one that I talk about. Let me just remember. Uprooted people plant their trees in pots. That's it. Uprooted people plant their trees in pots.
Spot on. It says it all.
It says it all.
It says it all. It says it all.
Yeah, so now I'm working on different things at the same time, but the one that I am working on right now at my desk is kind of creating a collective of haiku poems derived from my interviews, just like the one that I just read for you. That's one thing. Another one is now I would love to turn my creative work into academic work, and I would love to go and share with people, academics this time, how I work with academic findings, academic data into creative work with the academic language so that I can reach to the academic audience, you know.
Okay.
I want this to be experimented by other academics as well. So it's just, you know, a kind of ball I play with between academia and artistic work. From academic work, artistic work, now I want to express my experiment, my experience with this transformation in academic terms. And then I will be back, I'm sure, get inspired for another artistic work. This is how it works for me.
Well, that's the way it should work. It goes backwards and forwards. And for you to write poetry, you need to be inspired. And you're obviously inspired by a lot that's happening in the public space, in the public sphere. You just hear one word and it triggers off a whole project. Because we're coming to the end of this lovely conversation, we could carry on for hours. Is there anything you want, any kind of message you want, anything you want to say before we do close?
Yeah, as you said, we can continue talking forever. I do want to say one word and leave the conversation with this. My experience, my studies, my creative work tells me one thing, that everyone, everywhere in the world needs to be seen, needs to be recognized, appreciated. Anything we ignore intentionally will pop up as something bigger than us. Something in a way that would start harming the possible coexistence. I named my project "We Are Not Ghosts," and it's a phrase I took from the Varoshiodes, saying that why do you call our city a ghost town? We are not dead yet. This is a call for visibility. This is a call for the fact that they still exist and they demand life back in their city. And this, we are not ghosts, is not only for them. Think of yourself anywhere that you made invisible. I, as a Turkish Cypriot, feel invisible on this island sometimes. And I want to say, I am not a ghost. See my experience. See my experience of trying to survive in an unrecognized country.
I remember a friend of a Turkish Cypriot friend of mine, I'm not sure if I should mention her name, so I won't, who said to me, I really object when Greek Cypriots talk about the occupied territories because that is my home.
I can
I
relate to
live
that.
there. I live there. That is my home. So really, I find it offensive and hurtful when I hear the term the occupied territories.
I relate to this, and this is about being visible, visibility as well. Like every time I meet a new friend from the South, Greek-speaking Cypriot, they try to understand where my roots are, and they ask me, "Are you from occupied Cyprus?" And it breaks your heart. I do recognize the fact that it is a military occupation, but I do live there, and I'm
Yes.
not, I don't like to be identified as the occupier because I'm Cypriot, you know.
Yes.
I want the Cyprioteness to be seen, and it creates me calling, we're not ghosts to define the memory of Greek Cypriot Barossians. It creates a kind of dialogue and mirror for them to see me as well.
Yes.
And the way that I say we are not ghosts in their name, I in fact talk on my name as well, saying that I'm not ghost either, you
No,
know?
I mean, when my friend said this to me, it was such a light bulb, not a light bulb moment, because it didn't occur to me. Because in Greek, you automatically say takatechomena. In English, I don't. In English, I always talk about the north. But it actually made it a lot more real when she said to me, it hurts me when people talk about the occupied territories. I live there. There are people living there. I think that's a good note to finish on, because it's a we all need to be seen. We all want we don't want to be seen, we need to be seen.
It's a
Okay.
human right to be seen. It's a human
Exactly. It's exactly. Nadia, please don't forget to send me the link, both links. I really always enjoy conversations with you. And look forward to having a cup of coffee when time isn't an issue.
Yeah, of course. And I want to have a check on your tattoo. I might have a tattoo of the oleander tree. Oh, beautiful. It's beautiful. Wow, it's beautiful.
Okay, so thank you very much for taking the time,
You
Nafiamu.
for having me. Thank you very much.
And to the listeners, thank you for listening and stay safe and always remember home. And remember that home is different for everyone. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye bye.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus. Island Talks. Open, diverse, free.